Receiving this message. We are Ken Jennings and John Roderick. We speak to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century.
Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost.
So whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you.
This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus.
You have accessed entry 864.LV0723, certificate number 51232. Olestra.
Oh, I like the sexy Barry White.
Olestra.
This is part of my continuing series of 90s topics for Millennials.
I know you feel very pressured to not just have all of our topics be like
stuff we watch as kids. Hey, yeah. Johnny Quest. Every episode of Johnny Quest is now an omnibus.
Boomer content for Gen X TV kids.
I mean, really, the reason it's quite clear the reason why we aim the show at boomers and Gen X, they are the last Americans with disposable income.
Interesting.
No, we do it because
we're not trying to sell anything though, except Casper. We don't even sell Casper mattresses.
We sell bidets.
Yeah.
From time to time.
And hair loss treatments.
Yeah, and hair loss treatments for your butt. the reason why we kind of fall back on a lot of mid-20th century stuff is because the point of the show is this is stuff that's gone down the memory hole.
Right.
And a lot of the millennial culture is too recent to know what disappeared oddly quickly.
What's interesting is that you, still being on social media, are still worried about what people think of you, whereas I'm just going to increasingly do shows on Soviet airplanes and, you know, and no one's ever going to yell at me about it because how would I know?
They can yell, but you won't hear.
Right.
If somebody yells at you in a forest and you're not on Twitter, does it even make a sound?
Doesn't make a sound. Whereas you're going to get letters for every time you do an episode from somebody that's like, why don't you ever do Care Bears? And you're going to be like, Care Bears? There's no story there.
But Olestra really is something that disappeared down the memory hole, down the drain,
if you will. Down some hole.
oddly quickly.
Now, this feels like a thing that that is very current to me, too. What's the Olestra time frame?
Interestingly,
isn't this really more of a Gen X topic than a millennium one?
Olestra invented in 1968.
Okay.
But the
year I was born.
But they didn't get government approval for decades. This is a mid to late 90s cultural story.
Oh, so only 90s kids will get this.
Only 90s kids will remember this episode of Boy Meets World where they eat light chips. Do you have beloved snack foods of your childhood that are not made anymore that you kind of have nostalgia for? Just crap you can't buy at the market?
I mean, what I have nostalgia for is candy bars that are candy bar sized and packages of M&Ms that have a proper amount of M&Ms in them.
You don't like the shrinking of...
Right? Everything's gotten smaller, and I remember
when... To keep the price point the same.
Yeah. I remember when I first saw a Hershey bar that was not the size of a Hershey bar, but was a smaller... a facsimile, and I was that was one of the first real outrages I felt. When I look at Girl Scout Thin Mint cookies now, and I compare them to what Thin Mint cookies were in 1978, I just feel like
Is it different because there's only like 12 to a box?
Well, and they're so small, they have so little chocolate and mint on them.
Oh, the cookies themselves got smaller?
Yeah, the whole experience is smaller. The cookies are just like crackers now.
I mean, I love the Girl Scouts, and I love their cookies. I'm not down on anything about this.
Right.
But I do think that box doesn't have to be that big if you're only putting in 12 tagalongs.
If you look at Willy Wonka and
hold on.
And his let me Google. Wonka bar or whatever. What was the bar that the gold ticket came in?
Yeah. Oh, it's a Wonka bar.
Yeah. If you look at the size of that thing, it's the size of a, I mean, it's the size of a paperback book. And that's how I remember chocolate bars. Now, maybe I had small hands, but I definitely know that a Kit Kat bar used to be, you know, you could use it as a weapon.
Today, you can't break it in half.
Yeah.
It's you small. Literally would need forceps.
So that's what I miss. Oh, and I guess I also miss just being able to buy a bag of Cheetos and not having to go through 1,000 hot Cheetos flavors. And lime flavored Cheetos. So all of these are just like old curmudgeon problems. It's not like they've stopped making any of my favorite desserts.
I mean, the serving size thing is relevant. We'll cover some ground here related to, you know, the fact that the Willy Wonka bar is from an era before anyone would care if a kid ate a thing of chocolate the size of a 2x4.
I mean, I also miss full-size newspapers.
You just want things in general to be larger because you'll feel small and cozy?
Well, people used to be smaller, but things were larger. Now I'm large and everything's small.
The culture is moving in the wrong direction.
It is. I either make me smaller or make things bigger.
I'm getting bigger, and these airline seats are getting smaller.
Cars are getting smaller.
Did you ever notice?
When I sit in a car now, my head touches the ceiling at least 50% of the time.
When your mama sits around the car... No, that's exactly true. I guess I'm being a little younger than you. I still remember the flavor explosion of there being 10 of everything. Oh, and I remember it kind of fondly, you know, like, and you know, I'm not actually clear on which of my favorite snack crap foods are not exist anymore. Like maybe I just don't go down that aisle anymore because I know I can't eat that food. Maybe they only have them in Pennsylvania.
When did Cheetos Puffs arrive? Because I support Puffs. I will eat both kinds of Cheetos. And I have no complaints.
Both density of Cheeto?
Both Cheeto densities.
Do you test to see if they float in water like a witch to see if you'll eat them?
No, because that feels like one of those things where you put cotton candy in a pond in front of a raccoon. Or you get, yeah, it just feels mean. But
one of those things.
But I do look at the weight of the two bags, and I don't know if you know this, but the weight of small crunchy Cheetos and the weight of puffy Cheetos. It's the same. You get the same amount of Cheeto.
You're just paying for air.
It's just the bags are bigger.
I like, do they make Hostess fruit pies anymore?
Oh, interesting.
Because those are delicious and they're terrible. I'm sure it's just like 70% palm oil by weight, but.
I feel like the Ding Dong is absolutely one of the things that in shrinking, the Ding Dong went from being a wonderful food to like a pointless food.
We need to reprogram this buzzer so it's just you saying
ding dong.
When the ding dong shrinks, it's not good food or
but
whatever,
like,
you said.
Hostess cupcakes and ding dongs both used to be, you know, I would get one in my lunch sometimes. My mom would surprise me with a foil wrapped ding dong or a Hostess cupcake. Hostess cupcakes always came in twos.
Yes.
And they were so good. They were like,
oh yeah, it's
the best.
It's engineered to what kids want in their mouth and bloodstream.
And now ding dongs are tiny little dry little husks of their former selves.
Maybe we just got more. Maybe we just got better palates.
I mean, I'm a dry husk of my former self, but I can tell that the ding dongs have changed.
You don't like the ding dong of Dorian Gray? You've got one in your cupboard. As you stay young and fit, the ding dong is
so beautiful.
Is wasting away.
I feel like I'm going to have to do a show on ding dongs eventually.
Ooh, Omnibus After Dark. We got, I have specific chips that I miss.
Which ones?
But these are going to be Gen X chips. These are going to be like 80s chips.
Well, what, name an 80s chip that I wouldn't, that doesn't exist anymore.
Tata skins.
I don't eat potatoes.
They're made from potatoes and skins that are real. Yeah, you're not going to know any of these.
No, I don't. And that's the thing. I never ate
the chip aisle. The chip aisle to you is just a small column of corn chips.
It's, if it is made of corn, I will eat it. But all the potato stuff just feels like it's for...
Tata skins had they were a potato chip on one side, but on the back they were like brown like a potato. Hmm. So you would feel like you were eating, you know, the kind of
gross
Applebee's fries that still has skin on the back.
I mean, I'll eat a Funyun. I'll even eat a...
You'll eat a root vegetable in chip form.
Yeah, I'll eat a pork rind even.
That's not a root vegetable.
In your culture.
From the pig plant, from the chicharron plant. So the Wow chips that Frito-Lay released in the 90s are, I think, still available.
Wow.
But not the Wunderkind they were in 1996 when Wow Chips sold $347 million, making them the best-selling new product in America. And the news accounts all say it's the best-selling new product in America. Is that like compared to anything? Cars? Computers? Like it sold more than the Pentium did?
Is it sold more by volume, by number, by price?
Maybe it was just the best, you know, maybe in supermarkets it was the best. It was the biggest selling, hottest new item of 1996.
Okay, now this is going to potentially date me, but I have no recollection of Wow Chips.
See?
I'm looking at a picture of them right now.
This is why I have to do the millennial shows.
I have zero memory of ever seeing this, and they can't possibly still be on the shelves because I've never seen one.
You were in some kind of a haze during this time.
Because this is not, it's not Wow brand, it's Doritos.
It's Frito-Lay.
Wow.
It's called Wow because they didn't want to call their chips Olestra. So Wow was kind of their trade name for this new miracle product that they'd been trying to get approved by the FDA for what, almost 30 years.
And it's like a fat substitute?
It's a fat substitute, and unlike many fat substitutes, it holds up under heat, so you can cook and fry with it.
But wait a minute. Oh, I see. So it's not like vegetable oil, which is still a fat. This is some other thing.
There are some things that have a fat-like feel, so you can replace the mouthfeel of fat in certain products. But what you want with fat, if you're an American of our era, is you want to deep fry things.
Yes, you do.
Or maybe a Scott. Aren't they always deep frying candy bars and pickles up there?
Or if not deep fry them, just fry them. I mean, you can fry them a lot of different ways.
You don't care about the depth of the frying. You just need your food fried.
Yeah, fry it. Fry it, damn it. Any way you can.
I don't have a minimum depth. Just fry me everything. So Olestra would fry. You could use it for, you could heat it and cook with it. The story of Olestra and the decades-long battle over it kind of begins in the 60s when the American, and maybe the Western idea in general, but I think America kind of led the way on this, and then it leaked into Britain and the EU and so forth, like so many of our worst innovations do. The 60s was the first time when we really started thinking about nutrition, not so much as the four food groups, like remnants of which you and I probably learned about in elementary school.
Food pyramid.
Yeah, I remember when there were just four groups, when we had the old textbooks that didn't have the pyramid yet.
Grains, fruit and vegetables, dairy, meat.
Correct. And really the point was to just get enough of all of these things because all food is good. All these foods are good. You just need to make sure you're getting enough and then you'll be a happy, healthy boy or girl.
My mom talks about the way she and my father ate in the mid 60s, and every night they had either a steak or a pork chop.
Those were the only two foods.
Rarely would they have some chicken, and then even more rarely fish. And then they would have a potato and like either iceberg lettuce or maybe, against my dad's protest, some broccoli.
They must have been so disappointed by your anti-potato stance.
Well, yeah. I mean, I've never met a person that celebrated my anti-potato stance. But I don't think, my dad ate bananas. I mean, I think they would.
Your dad's on the record is he didn't just eat a baked potato for every meal.
No, they had a bowl of fruit, I guess. But in terms of.
Yeah, dinner was different. Dinner had to be
a meat.
I think we've talked about this on the show before, but one of the innovations of Chinese food when white people and, you know, specifically at first Jewish people started eating there in American restaurants was that it was not a big cut of meat.
Right.
That's where the idea comes from that you're hungry an hour later, because it was the only American meal that would actually be vegetables and sauce instead of a big cut of some kind of red meat.
With some chopped up meat.
Yeah, there's still meat in there. But I mean, even then, you know, today that's pretty common. You'll have a little meat with your grains and your veggies.
Yeah.
And that was not the dominant American way to have dinner in the 50s and 60s.
Yeah, the lean cuisine hadn't been invented yet.
That's right.
I'm going to put that right next to here to the ding dong.
The sea change happened kind of in the 60s and 70s when instead of just saying all food is good, just make sure you eat a variety. This is the first period where we start to think about what the wrong things are to eat. Where we, for the first time, and it's going to be hard for younger or future people to realize this, there was a time when nobody was scolding you for eating the wrong things.
And the wrong things were a reaction to kind of trying to discern why there was heart disease or why there was
high blood pressure? This is the main thing that happened, is that there was a decline in infectious diseases around this time because the germ theory of medicine had finally won out. We had good vaccines. We had cleaner water. Americans were living longer and not dying of infectious disease. But what that meant is heart disease just skyrocketed. So instead of perceiving this as a plus, hey, we're living long enough to get heart disease, people start thinking, what are we doing wrong that so many fine American dads and grandmas and so forth have high blood pressure and get heart attacks?
It's so funny because right away we wanted to start living forever, and no one had put any thought into this because even when you live to be 75, you really run out of things to do.
The question is, which kind of cancer are you going to get? Because what else are you going to do with your day?
But also, like, come on. I mean, just sit in front of the television, like, might as well kick it off.
I wonder if the invention and adoption of television actually helped increase this idea that, you know, just subconsciously, this idea that we should be living longer because
there's so much more TV to watch.
Well, yeah. And there's something to pass the day in your 70s and onward. Whereas, you know, before the radio.
Right.
Part of your mind in your 70s was probably just assuming, well, you know, death, please take me now.
Yeah. Once you're no longer working, I'm sure all the people who are working around you are just like, oh, God, do I have to walk around granddad's chair again? Like, come on, clear this space.
And I feel a lot of guilt about kind of being that person, being that kind of young person thinking, well, we visited grandma last month. We don't have to see her again so soon, right?
But you weren't wrong.
Well, not from grandma's point of view, I was.
Yeah, but that's one of the things.
I mean, I guess grandma had Fox News. She was she had something to be angry at. That wasn't me.
That was what drove me crazy as my dad got a little older. I was like, what, your primary activity is watching me? Like, seeing me come over? Like, come on, you've got to, like, I'm also an autonomous being.
The other thing that happened around the same time as heart rate started to rise is, Dwight Eisenhower made the great mistake of having a heart attack in 1955.
Oh, come on, Dwight.
And his forward-thinking doctors, you know, the president gets the best care at Walter Reed. They told him, look,
you got to stop eating so many.
Your arteries are in terrible shape. Okay. Stop eating this fatty food. You need to eat more whole grains, more vegetables.
Now, how did these doctors know that? I mean, Eisenhower's a general. He's in great shape, presumably.
Maybe he needs more steak.
Yeah.
How do you know which way to go? Clearly, he's not getting the right amount of steak.
Yeah, right.
How do you know it's too much?
Too much, too little?
Maybe it's too little.
How do these doctors suddenly understand all this about grains?
Well, one of the leading voices on this, you're eating the wrong stuff, and it kind of, it's really a sea change in American food because suddenly eating and meal planning becomes all about self-restraint. For the first time, it's not like, pick some delicious foods and eat them. Now it's like, look, we all know what foods are good, and you just need to eat less of them than you want to, which is kind of the paradigm that continues today.
Is this derived from Kellogg trying to give people molasses enemas or whatever?
Kellogg is actually part of it, not the enemas so much. In general, the enemas are going to go in the other direction on this show. A lot of it actually comes down to a lobbying group called the CSPI, the Center for Science in the Public Interest,
okay,
which was kind of the first nutrition-centered consumer advocacy and lobbying group, you know, the NRA of kale, if you will.
I feel like it's the type of acronym that I would give a door-to-door canvasser $10 just to get them off my porch. Like, yeah, I'll join this, sure.
I will cross the street to get away from the CSPI guy with the clipboard.
Have you heard about the CSPI? Oh, sorry, I don't live here.
The CSPI, it sounds like it's something that could go up 10%, and then you don't know if that's good or not. Hmm. The CSPI is up 10% this year.
The CSPI is down. I need to move some money around.
The CSPI was founded by a guy named Michael Jacobson, who was kind of a Nader acolyte. Again, okay, this is the dawn of the...
But this is pre-Nader, right? Or is this post-Nader?
No, this is it gets founded in the early 70s.
Because, you know, I worked for a couple of Nader organizations.
And voted for him twice.
I did. But I work for the Public Interest Research Group, and I work for the National Environmental Law Center. So they're all four-word public interest groups.
And doing great work. Because who else at the time was saying, hey, not everything that General Motors does is good for every American?
Right.
In fact, they were saying the opposite thing.
The opposite thing.
Which is much catchier, honestly. You can see why what's good for General Motors is not always good for America.
That's pretty catchy,
it's
though.
It's not likely to be in a convention speech.
It fits on a t-shirt, whereas what's good for General Motors is not necessarily good for every American.
May or may not be. We don't want to commit. It depends on who they are. And maybe the least privileged ones are taking it on the chin the most.
That's a long t-shirt.
It's got a lot of, like a lot of the correct views today, it has a lot of subordinate clauses.
Right, if and statements.
And nuances. And the CSPI kind of establishes itself as America's scolding mom. It's food police, telling you which things you should not be eating. And by 1980, the federal government follows through on this movement that the CSPI has kind of been on the vanguard of, and, you know, calling congressional hearings.
There was so much scolding in the 70s, and as children in the 70s, like, why did we get scolded so much? We weren't doing anything.
Well, everybody did, because it produced Jimmy Carter,
right?
Who decided, you know, America needed a good talking to, and and just some better habits, like
drive less,
turn down your thermostat,
wear a sweater,
why all that lead in your gas?
Sure.
Why are you eating all those ding dongs, John?
Yeah,
he went door to door.
I can't drive 55. Ken,
exactly.
Or Jimmy.
Why are you not using the metric system and driving much slower on the interstate?
Yeah, no, thanks.
Terrible, terrible Jimmy Carter that I have there.
That was a bad Jimmy Carter
impression. Really terrible.
And it sounded closer to Bill Clinton.
But then Ronald Reagan. Oh, no, see, we're not doing this. And the federal government follows suit in 1980 and produces the first dietary guidelines.
I remember this.
But isn't this weird that it's only 40 years ago? Before then, the federal government has a website with 100 ideas of the kinds of things you should be eating and not eating.
Was this during that presidential physical fitness thing too, where you could do so many pull-ups and you would get a little sweatshirt with
that
a seal?
That seems like
on
it's that's going to be an omnibus for sure. That's got to be some Eisenhower heart attack hangover plus Kennedy touch football. Ease and grace.
But this whole food pyramid thing is only
in our lifetimes.
To 1980.
Yeah. And
crazy.
And the CSPI.
It feels like it's from the Bible.
Right. And for the first time, you know, the food pyramid gets adjusted many times since then, but this is really the idea. You need to be eating a lot of these good things and a little of these bad things, and really none if you can handle it.
Yeah, all the way up to the tip.
That was
just the tip.
Just the tip. That was the hard thing for me because, you know, previously the messaging was, yeah, we all know this, you know, this candy bar is probably not good for you. So, you know, make sure you eat good things too. And now it was really like, look at yourself in the mirror and say, you should not be eating that candy bar at all. Feel bad about yourself if you do, but that's, you know, humans are weak in a fallen world.
The thing about meat, dairy, grains, and fruit and vegetables is that you can have strawberry shortcake and
That's two to three groups.
That's three groups,
if
and then
puts,
a
if
hamburger.
If you put some jerky on it.
Ice cream definitely fits in there. So when the pyramid got more detailed and some of those foods got, you know, sequestered to smaller and smaller parts of the pyramid, I kept looking for, and I know my dad did, kept looking for outs. What are the outs?
The good thing about the four groups is you can think of something you like in all of them. So it's an easy sell in textbooks.
Pizza.
I like bread. I like hamburger. I like
cheese.
Apples. And I like, which one did I leave out? Cheese. Yeah.
Cheese. You didn't even have to pick a vegetable.
Ice cream was
ice
cream was in the dairy one, you know?
Well, yeah. And my dad loves strawberry ice cream, and I'm sure he considered that a fruit and a dairy.
Cake is a grain. Pie is a fruit. It was a huskier time.
But in the pyramid, yeah, you had to.
The pyramid is a judge.
There was a big section at the bottom that just looked like raw wheat.
The pyramid just makes you feel bad about yourself.
Yeah.
Because the big part is just green vegetables full of iron and vitamin A.
Oh, come on.
And we were all still boiling our vegetables to make sure they were gross.
Yeah, white
at
asparagus.
At the same time as we were making people eat them. And the CSPI kind of leads the way on this with ad campaigns that have a lot of the kind of mom scaremongering that came with a lot of this good consumer advocacy.
Mm-hmm.
Literally, do you know what your kids are eating?
Ugh.
Like Satanic Panic style stuff. And they had their own villain, which was not...
Was it the Noid?
It was not the Noid, but you're close. It wasn't Satan's Daycares, but it was fast food. So
sure.
I guess it kind of was the Noid.
Sure.
It wasn't pizza, but it was Mickey D's. It was this kid's holding this hamburger, and guess what? That patty is 23% fat.
Yeah.
And this kid's drinking a shake, and guess what? That shake has more sodium than his fries do.
I remember this. And I was that kid.
And the fries have beef tallow in them, because McDonald's did put beef tallow in its fries until the 90s, and they tasted so good.
Right. They don't anymore? You can be a vegetarian and eat McDonald's fries?
Yeah.
Oh, interesting.
And I think that was it. It was like, wait, vegetarians just figured out they couldn't eat the fries and they were losing business. Oh, so right. They had to put in some vegetarian stuff that tasted a little bit like beef tallow. They figured it out.
I never eat potatoes, so I don't remember McDonald's fries being good or bad.
This is all coming, right. Exactly. You skip the fries anyway. You're like, hey, got any Funyuns?
Who cares?
Yeah. Sir, this is a McDonald's.
Why don't you have Cheetos here? Well, I would just get a strawberry pie instead.
This is all coming out of the lipophobia that came out of the rise in high blood pressure and Eisenhower's heart attack, Ike's heart attack. The idea that you're eating all this gooey fat, and as a result, it's coating your arteries with gooey fat. It just seemed to make sense in a very visceral way and a gross way. Like, ew, well, of course I don't want to eat a lot of fat. It's covering my insides with this yellowish gunk that's going to give me a quadruple bypass by the time I'm 50.
My dad had a heart attack in the 70s.
My grandpa did. My dad's prone to it as well. It's, you know, when people live longer, they have heart attacks.
Yes.
And there are nutritional things you can do, but it became cemented in the public mind that fat in your diet is the worst thing. Fat in your burger. Why isn't that person eating a ground turkey burger? That would have less fat.
Yep. Less fat.
Why aren't your kids drinking skim milk? That would have less fat.
We all started eating chicken in the 80s.
That's right.
Where none of us had ever eaten chicken before. And suddenly it was like, chicken is health food.
Moms loved it because it was a little, you know, they could pare down their grocery budget.
Right. Cheaper. It's
that was a big deal in an era where only one parent worked in a lot of these two family homes. And so you had the dynamic of a mom trying to economize, you know, a dad trying to earn and a mom trying to economize. And it was
a coupon, 17% interest.
Big agenda for her to try to keep the grocery costs down because she felt like she was, you know, the patriarchy had put her in a position of beseeching for money to feed her kids.
The first time I ever had chicken Alfredo in a restaurant, I did it thinking to myself that I was getting a healthy meal because it had chicken, and I'd heard so much in the newspapers about chicken being the new health food.
As companies figured this out and dialed back on fat, of course that makes food taste less good, and so they compensated by adding sugar and salt.
Sure.
And the Sugar Council was able to, you know, they loved this. They were able to straight-facedly go in front of Congress and brag about how their food is just pure calories, the same as any other energy-lending food. And, you know, it's important to note, sugar, totally free of fat and cholesterol.
I had a very, very impression, a moment that made a big impression on me. I was working, this is in my very early 20s, working at a stock brokerage as a clerk. And the woman that kind of ran the cage, the clerk's area, I overheard her talking to another woman that worked at the brokerage, and she said, I made a big tray of brownies this weekend, and I ate the whole thing by myself. But you know what? It was fat-free. The entire thing was fat-free, and so I just sat and ate the whole thing because it was completely fat-free. And I was standing there, you know, minding my own business with my green visor on, typing up checks for the Gates Foundation or whatever, and thinking, wait a minute, that doesn't mean it's calorie free.
It seems goofy now, but this was what that kind of fat phobia of the culture had fed us. The idea that if you ate fat, you would get fat and your arteries would get fat. It stands to reason. It's the same word. But
there were 20,000 calories in this
pan of brownies,
box of brownies.
Also, how do you make fat-free brownies? What's your butter or shortening substitute?
Well, it was probably Olestra. I mean, I don't remember what it was, but it was she bought a box at the store that said fat-free.
In this environment of America becoming increasingly worried about dietary fat, two scientists at Procter & Gamble in 1968 are trying to find a way to make fat more digestible to infants. You know, malnutrition's still a problem for babies. How do we get their little bodies to absorb more of the calories they're getting through, you know, largely through the fat in breast formula. Milk or formula, and then the foods that come after it. And they accidentally, because they're not very good at their jobs apparently, do the opposite. They produce fat that is much harder for the body to absorb.
Oh.
The triglycerides that make up most of the dietary fat in our food are three fatty acids attached to a glycerol molecule. What the scientists have done is replaced the backbone of this molecule with sucrose, which is a larger, more complicated molecule, sugar. It's got more place for more fatty acids to grip onto.
The fatty acids are agnostic about whether or not to whether they choose glycerol or sucrose.
You can make them choose sucrose because I guess that's just how organic chemistry works. Mm-hmm. And because the sucrose molecules are bigger and more complicated, you can get like 7 or 8 fatty acids on one of those babies. And you'd think that would be worse, but it's not. It just makes the molecule so big that your body can't metabolize it. It goes right through the intestine without the intestine ever getting any nutritive or caloric value from that fat. It's so garbage in, garbage out.
You get the delicious taste and feel of fat and sugar.
That's right.
But your body just turns it into expellation.
Yes. What's the nice way to say? Your body will pass it along back to the environment. And
night soil.
It's night soil. Procter & Gamble immediately realizes what they have here.
Oh, yeah.
A fat substitute that doesn't put fat in your body.
I'm still looking for it.
And they try to get FDA approval. Unfortunately, this turns into a decades-long back and forth.
Why? What's the problem?
The problem here is that the FDA is really good at testing stuff for toxicity. You know, you give a little bit of it to rats, and then you give more and more of it to rats, and you see at one point the rats die.
Right.
That's not going to work here because you've created a whole new macronutrient. You've kind of turned diet on its head, and you need to do more than prove it's non-toxic.
Right. I mean, you could feed rats only this until they starve to death because it brings no nutrients into their bodies.
For 10 years, there's a lot of back and forth. Finally, in the mid-70s, they just give up.
Who does? The FDA or
Procter & Gamble? Just gives up. And it's not until 10 years later when you probably remember this little nutrition boomlet. Nutrition, like anything else, is faddish. In the mid-80s, Kellogg, based on new research showing that you can lower cholesterol, we're still very fat worried. You can lower cholesterol with certain healthy grains. I think oat bran in particular was mm-hmm. shown to lower blood cholesterol. And so Kellogg applied to the FDA to start putting lowers cholesterol on some of its oat cereals.
Yep.
And the FDA rolled over. And Procter & Gamble says, look, if we're gonna say this is something the FDA can certify, let's go back to the drawing board and try to get our giant fat molecules out the door.
Was this because the Reagan administration had a new mandate to the FDA to just like green light, like stop being an impediment to industry?
I wonder if that is part of it. I didn't think about that at the time, but it's true that all their difficulties were, late 70s, early 80s. And then in the heart of the Reagan 80s, they, deregulation and so forth, they take up the baton again. And so this continues on for another decade. In the end, during this 30 years of FDA back and forth on Procter & Gamble's new additive, there are 150 studies done, 150,000 pages of scientific findings on the effects of what they're calling Olestra. Procter & Gamble is having to extend their patent on this molecule.
And it's never even been
because
released.
Nobody's had a bite of it yet. The FDA is worried about a couple things. You know, in addition to toxicity, they're worried about, well, will this just make people eat more fried food? Like, does this make people net unhealthier, even though they're eating
right
less fat or metabolizing less fat? They're just going to think they can eat a whole box
tray of brownies.
Yeah, the whole tray of brownies effect, right? Also, the fact that it's going right through your intestine without getting metabolized means you're not absorbing vitamins anymore from what you eat. So
they can't separate the vitamins so that the vitamins are absorbable.
That was the workaround. Eventually Procter & Gamble said, look, we'll add vitamins A, E, C, and K, or whichever the vitamins in question were, to all the snacks that we put Olestra in instead of regular fats. Procter & Gamble also has to limit, to try to get this government approval. They limit it. They say, okay, fine. We won't actually fry a bunch of stuff in this. We won't put it in brownies. We're going to say this is just for chips and crackers. Like, all we want is to put this in chips and crackers. Oh, okay. Please.
All right.
For the love of...
They're hoping that once the door is open to crack, that they can...
Exactly.
Yeah.
But it is not until January 24th, 1996. So, wow. I guess
that long ago.
We're getting to, that's the middle of the Clinton era.
Mm-hmm. Which is a great time for an explosion in fried foods.
Right. The fast food stigma has surely been lessened by Bill eating a couple quarter pounders after every jog, right? The day before their patent is about to expire again.
Wow.
And this is how you know that there's some collusion there between industry and government, which otherwise never happens.
Sure.
The day before their patent is due to expire, they get FDA approval, which automatically confers you a patent extension. But the deal is, yes, it can only be chips and crackers. Yes, you have to throw in vitamins. And you're going to have to put a label onto this thing, a warning label telling the customer that there have been some side effects reported.
And this, so in the testing, there were side effects?
Yes. And in Procter & Gamble's private testing, they were never able to find any, weirdly. Mm. When third-party universities did tests on Olestra, they had some reported side effects. And the CSPI immediately jumps on this. They've been fighting this the whole way. They're fat-phobic, but they don't want...
Fake fact.
They don't want to give the idea that there's some good ways you can eat chips.
Right.
That would get rid of their whole kind of idea of self-restraint and virtue in food.
Yeah, they want you to eat two raw stalks of cabbage.
Yes.
Which comes in stalks. Old cabbage stalks, they call them.
And a little bit of goat cheese.
No salt, no, I guess it would just be, yeah, you're supposed to live on garbanzo beans and dreams.
They don't even have good fats. The idea that we're kind of internalized now that some fats are good and some fats are bad and some can, you know, fish oil can lower your cholesterol.
Right.
None of this has made its way into the messaging of the CSPI yet. So they set up a number, 1-888-OLESTRA, where they encourage people, I don't know, try it in your era. I don't know if this number still works.
1-888-OLESTRA.
Dial 1-888-OLESTRA and report the effects that you get. Are you dialing it right now?
Let's see what happens.
Report the effects that eating Olestra-filled wow chips from Frito-Lay has on you. Because what most of the studies have found is something unpleasant you do not want to put on a warning label. You know, we see in cigarettes, the warnings about smoking get more and more draconian on the labels. First it was...
Your call cannot be completed at this time. Please try again later.
Come on, CSPI.
1-888-OLESTRA,
I guess they don't care about what we think about delicious low-fat Fritos.
It would be so great if they had parked, like, like just some kind of vintage recording.
Like how you can still go to the website for Val Kilmer's The Saint or whatever.
Right.
And sadly, the CSPI just doesn't have the unlimited budget that some of these big studios do, Joan. The most commonly reported, and the CSPI would put out ads just kind of warning you. They had a whole ad campaign against Olestra. Don't think like you're getting something for nothing, America.
That's right.
This stuff's bad.
That may be where I learned that mentality.
Well, it was easy. you think that's what? I didn't know you had that mentality. I thought you had the opposite mentality.
No, don't think you can get something for nothing, Ken.
No such thing as a free lunch. Luckily for the CSPI, the side effects associated with Olestra were showstoppers. Most commonly reported would be abdominal cramping, followed by steatorrhea. The CSPI claimed were as many as one half of cases.
Whoa.
Steatorrhea coming from basically a portmanteau of, I think, a root meaning fat and diarrhea, just means if your body doesn't process the fat runs right through you.
Oh, dear.
And when there's too much fat in your night soil, you don't have the firm texture that we all look for when we make a little pan of brownies.
Mm-hmm.
And so people would have explosive bowel movements. Explosive.
That's not just passing through.
Well, yeah. I mean, the term that consumer groups wanted to use was anal leakage, because they knew nobody would eat something with anal on the bag.
No.
Well,
I would not.
Not coupled with the word leakage, anyway.
If it was called anal, if it was like a spicy,
like George Clooney's wife.
Yeah, like a spicy seasoning, like we use anal. I might do it.
What's the secret ingredient?
Anal.
In fact, the FDA finally, the P&G and FDA finally agreed on loose stools.
Oh, there.
As the wording, which is, you know, less vivid than anal leakage, but still not great. Still not something you want to associate with a delicious Super Bowl snack, right?
I'm reading an account here. Dana Laughlin of Plainfield, Indiana, said that her 12-year-old son experienced diarrhea for 7 days after snacking on 5 ounces of nacho cheese Wow Doritos.
5 ounces is kind of a lot, but still, 7 days?
He had an accident in bed at 4 a.m. and missed 2 days of school.
So this is the kind of case study that the reason why we have these cases is because the CSPI made sure to put them in front of America. They would literally have ads that would read things like, a 63-year-old Indianapolis woman ruined 3 pairs of underwear and had no friends for 2 days after eating Olestra chips.
Oh boy, no friends for 2 days.
I like the implication that your coworkers know which days you have diarrhea and they stay far away. Kind of like some kind of purification hut for Sumerian women who are unclean.
I wonder if you spend a few days ruining your underwear, but you still have friends, and then at a certain point you've ruined enough underwear that you lose friends, but they put you on a timeout for 2 days.
It sounds like this woman's problem is she was telling her friends every time she had diarrhea. You don't need to call your friends, Lacey.
Well, but if you're ruining underwear right and left, your friends are going to notice.
You think they figured it out?
Well, sure. I mean, I think so.
If they're coworkers, the coworkers notice how many bathroom breaks you take. So if they're coworkers, they're probably picking up on the 63-year-old Indianapolis
woman. Right. If you're just like, she's in the bathroom again, and then there are unholy sounds coming from the bathroom. And
that's why nobody poops at work. But, you know, with Olestra, sometimes you don't have the choice. I've had this experience. It's not quite the same as diarrhea because it's really just, you know, the problem with diarrhea is the amount of water that's being retained or not in your bowels.
Right.
Whereas with Olestra, it's literally changing the texture and composition of the results. It's making it greasy. You can get these same results today without eating a single bag of light Frito-Lay product.
Tell me, Ken, how do I get these results?
Well, there's a restaurant in Seattle that used to serve a carpaccio of a fish called Escolar.
Okay.
Which has a delicious, smooth, buttery flavor. It's sometimes called the butterfish or the oilfish.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, it contains a particular kind of complicated fatty oil that just goes right through you. Mm. And once I made the mistake of eating a delicious tray of this Escolar, some places I think even have to put a menu warning about it. Like sushi restaurants have to tell you, hey, you might regret this Escolar in a few hours. But I ate a plateful of Escolar carpaccio and then went straight to a Shakespeare play.
Oh, dear. How many friends did you lose?
During Act One alone, I went through 3 pairs of underwear and lost all my friends.
For 2 days.
So leakage kind of is the right word in a way. And so the CSPI knew this was a winning formula to get people to associate chips with going to the bathroom.
Yeah, but what were they getting out of it? They're not making any money. They're not earning any new friends or able to show off their clean underwear. Why are they such nags?
They've got test kitchens and labs, and they want America to feel bad about what it eats.
Yeah.
Because then they get what? Well, their funding comes from the research they publish, you know, the scientific research they produce. And they need to have just like your hottest posters today, they need to have a hot take on the big nutritional events of the day. And in 1996, that was Olestra.
So as a 21st century American, I'm always looking for, I mean, there's absolutely no, there's nothing in our modern life that isn't a transaction of some kind. Nobody does anything altruistically anymore.
Follow the diarrhea money.
Well, or they're just looking for faves. So how did these people profit? I see. They're getting government funding for their studies.
They're getting attention. Yeah. Yes. And the ultimate diarrhea is the ultimate hot take.
I'll say.
What's hotter than that? This all leads to a 2006 lawsuit filed against Procter & Gamble by some underwear changing customers.
Now, wait a minute. So this these products came out in the late 90s. And how long did they survive on the shelves? How long could I still buy a Wow chip?
So nothing, Olestra didn't go away, but if you measure in terms of sales or Google searches, it's Olestra is a shadow. It's an order of magnitude away from the success it was when it sold $350 million worth of Frito products in 1996. So what went wrong?
I mean, I remember this being the topic of a lot of late night monologues.
Oh, yeah.
Everybody was talking about Alestra, and then it completely disappeared.
It was the hottest food additive, and it made you poop weird.
If there are... It's
irresistible.
If there are still chips that cause anal leakage, you would think that would still be a... I mean, it would be a tough sell.
The labels were later negotiated away. And in fact, Procter & Gamble got rid of the lawsuit by... gave hundreds of thousands of dollars to some kind of nutritional initiative and put up a banner that said eat light or something. Like, you know, they really were able to kind of PR their way out of this lawsuit. Maybe there were cash settlements as well. I don't know. They replaced everyone's underwear. Mac Weldon.
That's the foundation story.
On the back of a napkin, Mac Weldon wrote down anal leakage, question mark.
That was pre-Mac Weldon. So I think it's probably one of these Fruit of the Loom, cornering the market.
Although Fruit of the Loom should love this. They're going to sell so many more.
It sounds to me that the people in the late 90s were carrying multiple pairs of underwear around in their pockets. I don't remember that.
Well, you had to if you're going to enjoy delicious light Fritos.
I mean, I was carrying different pairs of underwear around in my pockets, but they weren't mine.
Here were some of the problems that led to Olestra's kind of disappearance from the public sphere, the state in which we find ourselves currently in the year of our Lord 2021. First of all, it was never approved in Canada or the EU, the FDA did.
They're so superior.
They had a limited market, and they just love it when something's legal here and they can be the culture that says, oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, you can't eat that kind of fish here.
Yeah.
And you can't use that kind of gasoline. And
then I say, cow encephalitis or whatever.
BSD.
Spongiform cow brain.
There was a difference in taste. So, as we got more into snacks that were, actually tasted like food and not like chemicals, which is kind of a fairly recent discovery in the food world. We want to feed our kids the organic, goldfish that seem somehow healthier than the Orange Pepperidge Farm ones or whatever.
So Olestra didn't taste good?
It didn't taste as good. People said they could taste the difference. And I think that's kind of the trade-off. You know you're getting a zero-calorie chip. They were more expensive. Okay. So if there's two bags of chips on the shelf...
Always buy the cheapest chips.
I mean, that's true of tortilla chips.
Yeah.
And in this case, just a lot of shoppers were not willing to pay an extra 50 cents...
To poop.
To poop more. Uh-huh. I mean, what price can you put on that?
Well, now let me ask you, if you are having trouble pooping... Can you buy Olestra chips as a laxative?
Are you asking me to diagnose this unapproved product for a use the FDA doesn't? In that case, yes, absolutely.
Okay, good.
If you're constipated, you just need to fill up on Wow Doritos.
Okay, got it.
And a 2011 study, I think by Purdue University, found that people actually were just eating more. They were actually eating more calories because they'd finish off a bag of the Virtuous chips.
Oh.
So all this stuff about how this self-restrained approach to eating is wrong was actually correct.
Huh.
But the main thing that happened is our idea of unhealthy food changed for the better.
We realized there were good fats?
Right. We stopped being so terrified of fat just because it sounds the same as the word we use for obesity. Genius. Yes. As early as 1972, a British researcher named John Yudkin was all over this beat. He published a book called Pure, White, and Deadly, which linked...
It's about sugar.
No, it was about cocaine.
Oh.
But he also... No, it was about sugar. He had this paradigm-changing idea of what makes for unhealthy food. He pointed out that there are plenty of indigenous cultures, including like the Inuit people, where their food is extremely high in fat, and they do not have the high incidence of cancer and heart disease that all these studies claimed. There was a famous study by John Yudkins' arch enemy, this Minnesota nutritionist named Ansel Keys, who was the ultimate big data guy, who if you tried to go up against his idea of unhealthy food, he would say, well, I've got 30,000 people. I'm up to 30,000 people in my longitudinal study. How many do you have?
Ooh, burn.
And he performed a study called the 7-country study, where he showed that no matter where you looked, Greece, Latvia, Portugal, all over the map, you would find that the more dietary fat people ate, the more incidence of heart disease and cancer there would be.
Oh.
The problem is he was leaving out countries where everybody knew that diets were very high in fat, and yet heart disease and cancer incidences were surprisingly low, like France and Germany. These were places that are eating a ton of butter and everything and frying everything, and they were not having the same results. So
if he was using Greece, Latvia, and Portugal, it seems like he was specifically avoiding France and Germany.
I believe that to be the case. Think how hard you have to work to avoid France and Germany if you're testing European nutrition. Yeah. Like that's
if you're in Latvia and you want to go to Portugal,
you're gonna have to cross France or Germany.
You're gonna have to really tiptoe around.
I don't even know if there's a way to do it. And so Yudkin pointed to the idea that these indigenous diets were always high in fat, but what we would have evolved for would be to not eat carbs. We wouldn't have had access to grains and starches and sugar to the same degree we would have access to meat. So kind of in this early proto-Atkins thinking of what's the more natural diet, he said, the problem is not fat. We're evolved to eat fat. What we need to do is to cut out sugar. And his work was brutalized. It was quashed, not just by the sugar industry and a whole bunch of processed food industries that had built their business model around low fat but high sugar formulations, but also guys like Ansel Keys, who thought they had tons of data for their fat equals fat connection, and they were not going to put up with this maverick scientist.
Well, and also guys like me who love deliciousness.
Sure. I mean, it's a hard sell to try to tell people, hey, actually,
sugar is bad.
Sugar is bad.
Sugar, the greatest of all things, is bad.
Because when sugar was scarce, our brains evolved to just love it.
Sugar.
When Yudkin finally died, alone and unloved in 1995, he was still just this forgotten maverick whose books about how actually fat's fine and sugar's bad were forgotten and had been believed discredited. But in the meantime, we started to have to grapple with a obesity rise in children. And, you know, this has led to all kinds of knock-on effects. Some of them just terrible fat, you know, including terrible fat shaming of people of various shapes, you know. But there's really no getting around the fact that childhood obesity was skyrocketing in a way it never had before. And it was clear that something wasn't working about our fat-phobic 60s and 70s ideas about nutrition. And finally, the 1990s is when new studies started to come out vindicating Yudkin. They could find no link between cholesterol, you know, cholesterol, the villain of so many decades, could really find no link with bad health outcomes like, you know, high cholesterol, high dietary fat diets turned out to be not related to cancer or heart disease at all. But the thing about science is it doesn't like to backtrack, right?
Right.
Like if you've all these people who had dozens of years of getting elite, well-respected, peer-reviewed articles published about the dangers of fat and the comparative virtues of sugar, we're not going to walk that back. So it took a long time to turn around the boat.
It's funny because I always think of the Atkins diet as being some kind of 50s fad diet, but it really only started in the 90s.
Yeah, and Atkins had a hard time. Atkins was laughed at and shouted down for saying, no, just eat meat and cut out carbs, you know, because healthy whole grains were the foundation of the food pyramid. That's where you got your good carbs and your good calories.
Right.
And it was not until some of these studies started to come out about showing that our findings, and if you eat a lot of meat, well, meat's going to have fat. So it really took some of these new findings about fat and cholesterol to make Atkins seem timely and forward-thinking instead of like a crank.
I think people still think that Atkins is a crank just for different reasons.
Well, nobody likes anybody to tell them they're eating wrong,
yeah.
Right?
But also I think, you know, Atkins said like, oh, you can eat as much cheese as you want. And then somebody lived on cheese for 2 years and died. And
so the fact that we totally turned around on the dangers of fat, you know, the fat wasn't the boogeyman that was making us develop these weird lab chips.
Fat's not the boogeyman, but the boogeyman is fat.
Is he? Is that true? I mean,
no.
If he was chasing you, you'd probably be able to outrun him.
That's true.
I feel like all our monsters are very slender.
Yeah, that's true.
Dracula's svelte.
You don't often see like a portly monster.
Which is good. Like,
except for that hot dog eating one in Ghostbusters.
Nobody's going to adopt a more nutritious lifestyle because they just haven't been made to feel ashamed enough, right?
We talk about this a lot, the million-dollar ideas, but what if we wrote a supernatural thriller where the evil monster was like you know, a plus size monster?
Is that the ultimate representation that plus size people can finally be monsters, or is this just further
demonizing
an already shamed group of people?
I feel like in the monster genre, as you say, almost all monsters are thin and skeletal. It is time for a little bit more representation, I think.
Well, I guess
a Chubbins.
Well,
monster.
You could definitely pick your dog in the Kong versus Godzilla fight. Kong has a little more meat on his bones, right?
Godzilla's got pretty chunky thighs.
Yeah,
pretty
that's
chunk, right?
Right? I guess they're just different kinds of mesomorph. Hmm. So the idea has shifted back to, look, it's okay to eat some fatty meat, or it's okay if you put butter
it's
in your
okay
vegetables.
To eat some fatty meat.
Yeah, you could make a little rap about it.
But yeah, keep the floor neat beneath your feet.
And now sugar is the dangerous one. As a result, in 2014, Haribo, which, you know, the gummy bear maker, which, by the way, candy makers used to love this because they would be like, fat-free. Can you believe these healthy gummy bears we found that don't have fat? Of course they don't have fat. How would you?
They have horse's hooves and sugar.
What are you going to do?
Food coloring.
Are you going to slather Crisco on a gummy bear at some point in the process?
It's like saying your corn chips are gluten free.
Exactly.
Yeah, right. We know.
But the magic of saying your sugary candy was fat free started to dim. So Haribo was looking into how would they make gummy bears that could actually be sugar free. And it turned out one thing they tried is to replace their sweetener with something called lycosin, which is largely maltitol, a saccharide molecule too big to be absorbed by the body.
Wow.
We have not learned from the past.
Womp, womp, womp.
In 2014, they started to use the Olestra of sugars in gummy bears.
So the taste, your tongue still responds to the sucrositude.
It's sweet on the lips.
But your tummy can't take it.
Not forever on the hips because it goes right through. Unfortunately, it turned out that just like with Wow chips, these gummy bears did go right through you. People would buy them in 5-pound bags because that's how gummy bears come.
And they would come out as one giant 5-pound gummy bear that you had to figure out
that's
how to get
boss
out.
Boss level. Well, no, but people would eat an extraordinary amount of maltitol and a not recommended amount of maltitol. So if you look up the Amazon reviews for these sugar-free gummy bears, it's just 100% visceral CSPI-style descriptions of what happens to your toilet.
I ate 5 pounds of gummy bears. I dialed 911 a long time ago. I just feel like if you eat 5 pounds of anything, like you have to expect something terrible is going to happen.
But we can't teach eating that way, that it's just a way of, well, I don't know, can we? Like, maybe I'm okay with the Protestant approach to eating as long as it's scientifically accurate. Like, look, everything's delicious, but
eat a little bit.
Your body just is going to want too much of it. So you're going to have to be a virtuous ascetic for part of your day.
Small bites.
I don't know. Maybe I'm saying something. Maybe in a lot of people that leads to an unhealthy attitude toward food, and I don't want to be promoting eating disorders. But really, that's the only thing that works for me because—
You want everything.
I just want everything to be delicious, and chocolate devil's food cake tastes better than everything else.
I was at a restaurant not very long ago in Honolulu, and
humble brag.
There was a
did I mention it was in Honolulu?
It was a vegetarian restaurant. No, it wasn't. There was a big poster out front of all the people that had successfully eaten their, I don't remember what, 15-pound hamburger or 5-pound hamburger, whatever it was. And it was a very small group. You know, like 5 people.
Have you ever done one of those challenges?
No, I did one time at a bar in Ketchum, Idaho, order a steak that was like
I think we talked about
yeah,
this.
Eat the whole steak. But I was so—
That's how Hemingway died.
I was so drunk. I was so wasted. And the steak was so rare on the inside that I became very repulsed about a third of the way through the steak and just could not eat another bite. Not because I was full, but because I was just like, oh no. I think I was too wasted. Maybe it wasn't that I was drunk. It was also that I was on some cocktail of mind-altering substances that made me realize that eating a giant chunk of something dead was like really a bummer.
That's what all these psilocybin activists need to grapple with. The fact that, you know, you do all these mushrooms, you might just eat a weird amount of gummy bears or ham.
Yeah, you are not going to want to eat a steak, though. I mean, you might want to sit and eat chips, but you're not very hungry when you're on psychedelic drugs.
Oh, is that right?
It's not a, you don't get the munchies. You're very much more like, can I smoke 50 cigarettes? But I don't think you're ever like, boy, I want to dig into a big plate of something.
This is good. So this can be the Olestra we're recommending to the future.
Take mushrooms.
Psilocybin. That's the ingredient of tomorrow.
Yeah, if you're super, super high on psychedelic mushrooms all the time, you will lose weight.
Really? I won't want red velvet cake if I just eat enough mushrooms?
I don't think so. I mean, eventually you'll have to take some sustenance, but mostly just Gatorade.
I'm excited about the new me.
Yeah. And that concludes Olestra.
Whee!
Entry 864.LV0723. Certificate number 51232 in the omnibus. Futurelings, in the unlikely event that you are able to sustain yourselves with some kind of nutrition without either A, dying of some sort of malady,
Bloodborne
or B,
disease.
Pooping uncontrollably, or some other... I mean, I don't understand why it isn't a lot simpler to just have delicious food that makes you want to eat it all the time that also isn't terrible for you or super expensive.
I guess we probably do have some prosperity privilege here if we're speaking to subsistence hunter-gatherers about which are the right fattening foods to eat.
Well, we're going to get a lot of letters from the unicycle crowd who are like, we do have that. It's called delicious fruits and vegetables. Merk, merk, merk. Unicycle away.
I love fruits and vegetables.
Oh,
don't
sure.
Get me wrong.
Sure.
It's just, you know, I ate some mango slices this morning and they were like the best food, but they're only the best food if you don't also have a slice of red velvet cake sitting next to them.
That's right.
And as soon as that's there, you know, you're done with the mango.
You want that red velvet. That's right. You can see our archive at Omnibus Project on social media. You can find Ken Jennings at Ken Jennings very, very periodically. I will tweet about some Patreon content at John Roderick, but don't go there for anything hot unless you're looking for Patreon content. You can Gmail us at, which is the parlance of the time, at theomnibusproject@gmail.com. You can support our show at patreon.com/omnibusproject, and we greatly appreciate your support by joining our Patreon group at any subscription level. You can listen to our monthly addenda podcast, and then at other levels of membership, there are successive tiers of wonderful benefits, all the way up to the $1,000 a month level, where you get to go ice skating with me and Ken.
If in season.
Right. If you subscribe at the $1,000 level for 6 months or more.
Yeah. And you have to arrange to take us to a part of the world where there's currently solid ice.
Right. It's only outdoor ice skating that we'll do with you. So no ice rinks allowed.
If you're in Ottawa and the canal's not frozen the day that your donation hits, I'm sorry, we're not available.
Yeah.
We can't risk our health.
I mean, we will come and stay in a hotel waiting for it to freeze, but you'll have to keep us there. It has to be a 4-star hotel.
Yep.
You need separate rooms too.
$200 per diem.
You can, after you've exhausted yourself supporting us on patreon.com, you can socialize with other futurelings at the Omnibus Futurelings group on whatever social media platform you prefer. Discordant.
Dysentery.com.
Also Facebook and Reddit.
Dysfunction.
Disney. And you can mail us things. Real live things. Send us real things in the mail. Perfume-soaked letters addressed to Mindy Jennings at P.O. Box 55744, Shoreline, Washington, 98155. What have you got over there in the mailbag, Ken?
I don't know how lucky we are, but we get frequent mail from
two deranged individuals.
No, from Portland alt comics legend David Chelsea, who always just sends us bespoke art.
Oh, wonderful.
Look, this envelope, which he like hand calligraphed, has two omnibus entries here. Can you name this one?
Well, that's cherries.
Maraschino cherries. Classic John Epp. And on the back?
And on the back, it's a cucumber. It's a zucchini. It's a Christmas light.
Yes, it's a Christmas pickle.
A Christmas pickle.
Classic Ken Epp.
That is great. So we each got an Epp repped.
We mentioned the dodecahedron calendar that somebody sent us, and he sent us his dodecahedral holiday card, which, when assembled, turns into like a weird immersive 3D view of his front room.
Oh, how awesome is that?
Check it out. It's really great.
He's a very talented artist. We don't deserve him.
He really is. Look at the work that goes into it. And he sent us a couple of his own letter envelopes that he made available back in the day. This one is a lovingly stippled baby.
They appear to be living in an industrial loft in New York City here, not in Portland, Oregon.
Yeah, I believe that is true if that's from back in the day.
Yeah.
I think of him as an East Coast cartoonist. Am I wrong about that?
That's very cool.
And look at this one. What would you send? The baby struggling to drink his milk or Nixon loves checkers?
Well, Nixon loves checkers is a very, that warms my heart. That baby is a little bit much to take. Are those two envelopes that those are like stamped self-addressed return envelopes?
I think they are scans of envelopes he has sent in the past.
Oh.
But we could put a stamp on top of the pixelated out stamp and we'd be ready to go.
He is a wonderful illustrator.
It looks like this one has a link to dchelsea.com. If you've seen his work on our Patreon, you should check out his site. Thank you, David. Listeners, from our vantage point here in your distant past, we have no idea how long our civilization survived. We hope and pray that the catastrophe we fear may never come. Or if it does, we will certainly go through more than three pair of underwear and we'll probably lose all our friends.
For 2 days, at least.
To the radiation. If the worst comes soon, this recording, like all our recording, may be our final word. But if Providence allows, we hope to be back with you soon for another entry in the Omnibus.